I didn't realize that writing a column would like would be like being in a Godfather movie. You know, it's like I take one of theirs, they take two of mine, we go to the mattresses. It was very intense. You know, it got to the point where I was like afraid to walk past the White House. I thought maybe the Secret Service would arrest me or something.
Hi again, everybody. I'm Don Van Natta. Welcome to Take a Joke, the second season of the relaunched Sunday Long Read podcast. In this new version of the SLR pod, we now unpack captivating journalism themes over the course of four or five episodes. This season is sponsored by Funny Girls, a program from the Harnish Foundation that uses improv education to strengthen girls' leadership skills. And if you haven't already, check out The Art of Remembering, the first season of our SLR pod relaunch, which was all about obituaries. But this season is all about humor. Our first guest has been the thorn in the side of 10 American presidents and has managed to make decades of print readers laugh every week. We're thrilled to welcome the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist, Maureen Dowd.
Well, thanks for having me, Don.
Greatly appreciate it. I want the audience to know that Maureen and I have been friends for 26 years. We met in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times in 1997. I was intimidated by Maureen because I was such a huge fan of her work, how funny she was in print, and I quickly discovered she's also one of the funniest people in person. And she's had me laughing across a quarter of a century, and I'm so thrilled, Maureen, you've agreed to do this for us here at the Sunday Long Read podcast.
Well,
so,
you know you. I love the Sunday Long Read. Don knows that, because when I'm not in it, I complain bitterly.
Yes, you do. You do. And oftentimes you're right. You should be there. And you should be there every single time, particularly when you write your great long profiles. So let's start with this question. When did you first realize or maybe suspect that you are funny?
That's a good question. I think that the Irish just in general tend to blend the sad and the funny. I mean, we, in a way, Shakespeare does the same thing. In all his tragedies, he has a fool, and you have humor as a way to relieve the pain of life. And I think that Celtic people are sort of like that. They think of, you know, life has a lot of problems in it, and it's good to, you know, keep a gimlet eye out for the ironies and the hypocrisies and the funny parts of life, just as a comic relief.
Yeah, and you studied Shakespeare, and you wrote, in Shakespeare, it gets very bloody. It deals with primary emotions like jealousy and envy and desire, and I'm just very interested in primary emotions. And from my perspective, your column is a mix of both. And how do you think Shakespeare's work has affected the way you use humor and satire?
In ancient courts, the only person who could say the truth to the king without penalty was, there were two, the priest and the jester. And that is what the fool is used for in Shakespeare. And so I think about that a lot. You know, there's that old saying, a cat can look at a king. You know, I think I actually said that to the first President Bush once. You know, so you don't have to be at their level to be able to poke at them if they're doing something wrong.
What did the first President Bush say when you said that to him? Did he get the reference?
No.
Why am I not surprised?
No, I don't think so, no.
Maureen, you've credited your mom with contributing a lot of your humor. How did she feel about your writing?
My mom, you know, I as I'm sure I've told you, I had to spend 5 years in the Washington suburbs before before I could get back to, well, actually, the paper folded. I never got back. But, you know, I was doing the nitty-gritty of courts and schools, and I covered Montgomery County, Maryland. So the main story out there were either dentists who put their patients under anesthesia and attack them, or landfills. So I wrote a lot about landfills. And finally, my mom said, when you stop writing about landfills, tell me, and I'll start reading you again. But she also told me, when I started trying to write humor things, when I got to the Times, she said, you're so funny in the paper. And then she goes, but you're not funny in person.
I disagree with that.
But my mother had this fantastic, droll Irish wit. You know, she loved Oscar Wilde, and she watched Johnny Carson every night. And a good example of her wit is when I got the job at the Times, she said, all right, well, here's my advice. Get on the front page a lot and use the word allegedly a lot. And then when I told her one of my fellow columnists was doing a memoir, she paused and she goes, of whom? So that was her kind of wit. He was very self-regarding, but with that one line, she kind of put him in his place.
What was your mom's favorite column that you wrote?
Ah, my mom's favorite column. Well, I'm not even sure, actually. You know, she was my mom, so she basically loved everything outside of landfills.
So you have a great quote that I want to read to you from when you first got the column job.
Don, she did one time. I took her to the White House Christmas party with the first President Bush. And he kissed her, and he was very charming to her. And when we got in the car to go home, I hear this ominous voice, and she goes, I don't want you ever to be mean to that man again. So it's dangerous to introduce your mom to the people you're covering.
That's a very good lesson for all the journalists listening for sure. Absolutely. So I want to read this great quote about your first experience when you first got the column job at the Times back in 1995. You wrote, when I started doing humor pieces, Michael Kinsley and Bill Sapphire separately took me aside and said, don't do that. Thankfully, you didn't listen. But what did you tell them?
Well, I think they thought that it would seem girlish. And I was, I'm trying to think, there just weren't that many, there hadn't been that many women columnists. There was Anna Quinlan, and then there was me. And, you know, they were being protective. But I just fundamentally didn't agree with them, because I want the column and any writing I do to be a seduction. I want to lure you from one sentence to the next. And humor is a great way to do that, because we end up having to write about a lot of the same situations over, and people oftentimes get tired of hearing it. And I just feel like humor is a great delivery system. I think you can talk about the hardest things with humor and just make it easier to read. For instance, Jonathan Swift, you know, when the British were being very mean to the Irish, he did a satire about how the British were going to use Irish children to make in their stews. You know, they were going to cook them in their stews. And it was way over the top, but he got his point across, you know. So even with something like the starving Irish, he could use humor to make the point.
It's interesting that you say that they thought humor writing was girlish. You know, you've also written that men enjoy verbal dueling, but as a woman, you wanted to be liked, not attacked. So I'm curious at how you balanced the humor and the funny writing with being really tough, which I know you relish, obviously.
Well, I think when I first got the column, as you know, it was was when we met during the Clinton years, and I did a pretty sharp critique of the Clintons, and I didn't realize that writing a column would be like being in a Godfather movie. You know, it's like I take one of theirs, they take two of mine, we go to the mattresses. It was very intense. You know, it got to the point where I was like afraid to walk past the White House. I thought maybe the Secret Service would arrest me or something. So I went to Hal and I said, I'm not sure I'm cut out for this. Because, as you know, I'm like really shy and introverted. And I and that was before the internet really got going. And so Hal, as you know, had a certain way of dealing with these things. So he said, that's fine. You don't have to do the column anymore. I'll just send you back to Metro. So I had spent so many years on schools and courts and landfills that he scared me straight. And I just kept trying. But you do, as Eleanor Roosevelt said, have to have the skin of a rhinoceros as a woman, you know, taking on the guys.
Who is your humor sounding board?
Oh, well, you know, I was just thinking today, thinking about this interview, that it's really hard now because I was very excited after COVID to go back to the office and see all my friends, and nobody came back. And I've been sitting there for a year alone. And when you think of all the fun we used to have, even in the midst of chaos and impeachments and really serious things for the nation, but we were all kind of in it together. So, you know, when there was a Trump indictment the other day, you run out of your office looking for someone to say, oh, my God, you know, this is incredible, but there's no one there. And then there's going to be a Biden impeachment. There's no one to talk to about it. So, and especially with humor, that's hard because you need people to say, well, is this funny or is this too far, too much or stupid? And there just aren't any sounding boards around. It's very odd to have that total silence. You know, our newsroom has been so empty, and I'm in Washington, that the lights come on by motion detector, so the lights are never on. There's not enough human warmth to even turn
the lights
on.
Do you think the fact that there's no newsrooms anymore has hurt journalism?
Well, I guess the Wall Street Journal just put up a story that, you know, happy hours are a thing of the past, and that whole lifestyle we had. But I think journalism is one of the professions, and I know the publisher feels this way, that we really benefit from the collaborative, you know, cross-pollination and, you know, excitement and working together. And, you know, from my column, as you know, a lot of times people stop talking to me. So I really need to ask the reporters what's happening. And they're all home.
Yeah, that's one of my great memories of being in the Washington Bureau back in the 90s is, you know, you would pull me into your office and say, OK, let's talk about the Lewinsky scandal. And I felt honored. I mean, I was covering it as a reporter, and you would ask me what was going on, and your process seemed to me very quickly to be very collaborative in the sense that you talked to a lot of people. You, as you said, you bounced your jokes off of people. You would do that with me all the time. Again, I felt very honored to be the first person to hear the funny thing that a million people would read the next morning.
I have often told people that if I, God forbid, end up in some national scandal, the only reporter I would talk to is you. Because wow. You have this totally charming and sorceling manner, and obviously Monica thought that because you talked to her on the phone a lot, and you know, so you always know everything that's going on.
Well, that's very nice of you to say, but I want to get back now to now. How are you without anyone in the newsroom, with the lights out and everything else, you know, putting your column together?
It is really dispiriting because I was home for 2 years by myself at the dining room table with COVID. So then when we finally could go back to the office, I thought everyone else would have cabin fever too, but they don't. I mean, I understand the benefits of it. And, you know, for people with kids, it gives you a lot more freedom. But it does, in journalism, I just feel very sad about the loss of that legendary newsroom.
Absolutely, I agree. Do you find it harder to be funny sitting in the Washington Bureau alone?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was just, I think about an average day that we had, which would go on after work, because on those amazing historical days, then we'd go have a cocktail and debrief or something, all of us. And you're just not, it's you're not getting as much information. I just don't think Twitter serves the same purpose as having the Times, you know, has the smartest, coolest people in the world. And if they're all there, it's just like this amazing, you know, machine that's buzzing with life. And that just, the publisher, you know, he wants everyone to come back, and they're supposed to come back after Labor Day, but they're not quite back yet.
This season of the SLR podcast is supported by our publisher, Ruth Ann Harnish. And we're excited to tell you about another great thing she's a part of. It's called Funny Girls. It helps third through eighth graders as they figure out all the changes they're navigating. To do so, Funny Girls uses improv exercises, lighthearted activities that actually contain important lessons in leadership. The kids have a lot of laughs, but they also learn how to think on their feet, how to come up with creative ideas, and how to recognize their own abilities. Kelly Clarkson featured Funny Girls on her show. Just Google Kelly Clarkson Funny Girls, and you can see the whole thing. Have a potential eligible student in your life, or just want to know more? Visit www.funnygirls.org. That's www.funnygirls.org. Thanks again to Ruth Ann for her support of young women, this show, and the Sunday Long Read.
Maureen, you've covered a dozen presidents. Who was the easiest of the presidents to write about with humor?
Well, I think it's very hard now in the Trump era, because if you admit that Trump is funny sometimes, which he is, Democrats get mad at you because someone who tried to overthrow the democracy can't be funny. But in that sense, they blind themselves to the fact that that's one of his great weapons, you know, that his fan base thinks he's funny. And but you also can't use light humor about someone who tried to destroy democracy. So you can't, humor is gone. And also, if you think about it, who are the people who are sophisticated and witty in the public arena? You know, we don't have the Dorothy Parkers, you know, the Thurbers. We don't have those people anymore. I mean, now it's, I read in the Wall Street Journal about a young girl who does really bad dad jokes on TikTok. You know? That was on the front page of the journal. And, you know, Trump's version of humor, which is mean and crass. And it's just hard to think of anyone who had this sort of elan and wit of a JFK.
You go back to the 80s with Trump. What has that relationship been like? How has it evolved?
Well, Trump is a funny character because he was so like a Batman villain, kind of so over the top and narcissistic and egotistical. And you'd stay in a Trump hotel sometimes and his picture would be looking back at you like an infinity mirror. His picture would be on all the water in the minibar and, you know, everywhere you would just see his face. And then if you would go interview him at his office, he had all the magazine covers of himself framed. So again, it would be like an infinity mirror. And he was so easy to lampoon, but he was kind of oblivious to it. But it never in a million years occurred to me he could be president, because his typical conversation. He loved to do lightning rounds with me where I would just throw out a bunch of current events or people and he would give me a one-liner. But mostly, you know, his idea of conversation was Heidi Klum. Sadly, she's no longer a 10. One time he went on about how Halle Berry's face was an 8 and her top half of her body was a 10 and the legs were a 6. And you're just thinking, oh my God, this guy is so crass. He was satirizing himself almost. But obviously now you can't even make fun of him because despite being such a parody of himself, he nearly overturned democracy. So, you know, that puts you in a bind on humor. You don't want to do humor columns about someone who has had such egregious sins against humanity.
How hypersensitive was Trump when he was president, when you would take him down on something?
He stopped speaking to me. I had a book come out in the middle of the 2016 campaign, and he stopped speaking to me then. He thought it was too critical. And then I ran into Jared and Ivanka at a dinner party in Washington. And, you know, that was a truly scary moment because they were about to go to the Middle East and Ivanka was saying they were going to be bringing deliverables. And I thought my head was going to explode watching Ivanka talk about deliverables. But Jared said to me, you know, my father used to like you, but now he thinks you've gone crazy, which is his favorite word for women, you know.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And did you ask him why?
Well, I said, I went crazy. And Jared said, well, if you write 2 nice columns and a nice tweet, he'll forgive you.
That's all it was going to take. That's the formula.
Or 1 nice column. I was like, no.
Maureen, of all the presidents you've written about, who could take one of your biting jokes about them the best?
Well, certainly not Clinton. Oh, my right. Gosh. I can tell you the worst. I mean, who was the worst at it?
Yeah.
Was Obama.
Because, oh, really?
When Obama first came on the scene, I was blown away by him, and I traveled with him for a year, and he didn't have any foreign policy experience, so he took a trip to Paris and Germany to kind of make it look like he had foreign policy experience. And he gave each of the reporters on the plane like a 10-minute interview up in his cabin. So he did, you know, the guys. And then I went up there and I thought, this is great. A young black man. And finally, as a woman, you know, it's not going to be the guys with the male president playing golf, like Tom Friedman is always playing golf with presidents. Like, I'm going to have an even chance here, you know? So I sat down, I was all excited, and he told his aides, can you leave the cabin? I thought, this is great. He's going to give me some huge scoop. It's going to be like Scotty Reston and JFK. So they all leave the cabin. He looks at me and he goes, you are really irritating. Just thought, you're not even president yet, and you've already turned on me. And he said he really, I realized at that moment that it was very important to him to be painted as cool. And I did think he was cool, but not cool enough because he thought I was painting him as finicky because I did have a little bit of a good time when he was in the Democratic primaries in working class areas like Pennsylvania because he didn't like to drink the beer or eat the French fries. So we'd always pass them off to his body man. And, you know, in those areas, they're always trying to stuff you with waffles. And he didn't like any of that. So that was fun to write about. But he did not think so. He said, you set the zeitgeist, and I don't like the zeitgeist you're setting because you're making me sound finicky like I like endive salad. and all this stuff. And I'm like, but you do. I mean, yeah, the guy considered Altoids a three-course meal. His wedding ring was literally falling off his finger.
Yeah, this is the guy that counts out seven almonds, I think, or nine that he allows himself
to eat.
That's
right. And so one time when we were in the States on the primaries, he comes down the aisle of the plane, and I had been eating the barbecue that they gave us on the plane and reading a story about him. And the barbecue was smeared on the story, on my face. And he looked at me with utter disdain, and he said, "You got barbecue sauce on my face," meaning on the magazine. You know, so he was very sensitive about wanting to seem cool.
Well, when I asked you who takes your biting jokes, or who took your biting jokes the best, I assumed you were going to tell me Bush 41, because I know you guys had kind of a special relationship, particularly when you went to Kennebunkport.
Well, right? I had a good time kind of teasing him too, because, you know, he was like a big waspy golden retriever just bounding around. He was a character out of a Jeeves novel. So I would tease him. And then one time he went to Houston for New Year's, and Marlon Fitzwater and Bryn Scowcroft asked me if I wanted to go to dinner on New Year's Eve. And so we went to dinner, and Bryn Scowcroft, you know, who was a great gentleman, looked at me. He goes, "Maureen, we have a favor to ask you." And I said, "What?" And he goes, "Can you please not call the president Goofy again?" I said, "Okay, General Scowcroft, I will grant you that favor."
Tell me your Bush Kennebunkport story.
Yeah, so 41 was going back to Kennebunkport for some family events. And
right, while George W. Bush was president.
Yeah, because he didn't go back to Kennebunkport very much, but there was something he had to do. So I'm in my room, and what made it more delicious was the reporters had all gone out to dinner with some Bush official, but they didn't invite me. I guess they thought I was a columnist or whatever. So I'm in my room by myself, and the phone rings, and it's Karl Rove. And Karl Rove goes, "I don't know exactly how to say this, but, you know, 41 would like to see you, but he doesn't know how to do it because he doesn't want his son to know. And we're all on the same estate, and there are two sets of Secret Service agents, like W's and 41s. And so he hasn't figured out how he's going to get through the cordon of Secret Service agents, but he'd like to see you if he can figure it out." So without his son knowing, I just love that. So he didn't figure it out, but I just love that he was game enough to try it.
And he was worried that if President Bush of 43 found out, what would happen? Would there be punishment? I mean, was 43 mad at you at the time?
Well, I was extremely critical of the Iraq invasion and Katrina, but mostly I think it was the Iraq invasion. So, you know, I never wrote about this till 41 died, but he wrote me notes for 30 years. And even when I was writing critically about his son, he would write me notes and say, "I don't know why I'm writing you this note because you're so critical of my son." But we have this love-hate relationship, but I could never hate you. But I think, you know, he and Barbara agreed with me that W shouldn't have invaded Iraq and that he was in the thrall of Rumsfeld and Cheney. So they agreed with me about that. He never said that, but I'm saying, you know, it wasn't like he disagreed with my columns. And I don't know, you know, Marlon Fitzwater in his book described my columns as it would be like someone pulled a knife on you, but then the knife turned out to be rubber, that they, you know, they seem sharp, but they were actually gentle underneath. And I think that's how the father felt.
How do you feel about that? Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, I love that assessment.
Yeah, it's great. It's really great.
As presidents began to do, 41 didn't have a coup, and he didn't, he wasn't all graspy and tacky and didn't have an affair in the Oval Office. So as the presidents began to do more egregious things, the knife increasingly became less rubber, if you know what I mean.
Yes, absolutely. And tell me about President Biden, your relationship with him. I know it goes way back. I know you wrote about his plagiarism scandal, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. It's so crazy. We actually had a good relationship after the plagiarism scandal. I broke the Neil Kinnock story, and he had to drop out because of that in 88. And after that, somehow over the years, we got to have a really good relationship. And when he was vice president, I would go over and have lunch with him. And then when he was thinking of running, he would call me and talk about it. And then he asked me to come to Beau's funeral. And, he told me that Beau really wanted him to run, not Hillary, because he just didn't think that Clinton should be back in the White House. And, but I'm trying to think, a year out from Biden's winning the presidency, when he was just, on the campaign trail, I did do a story about, it was when Hunter was having an affair with his sister-in-law and his marriage was breaking up and all this stuff was coming out. And I wrote a very gentle column saying that Biden should get it together on the family. And he cut me off after that. But because Hunter is like the third rail.
Wow. So you haven't had no communication with him since?
None. And in fact, I'm the only one who doesn't get invited to columnist briefings and all this stuff. And as you know, this always happens to me. But I think the thing with a column is you're either going to be honest or you're going to, or you can suck up. And I had to be honest that Biden's family issues were, he and Jill put out a statement supporting Hunter and Haley, the sister-in-law. And, it was starting to be inappropriate, as we see now. There are just inappropriate things in that family. And I was just saying they should get it together on that. So I think that was a totally legitimate thing to write about.
Do you think the great relationship you had with Biden over all those years, the lunches and everything else, gave him an expectation that you would never write something that cutting, even though you didn't see it that way? I mean, did he see it as a betrayal, in other words, based on the long years?
He said to me once at one of these White House parties that, I always used to go to Christmas parties at the vice president's mansion and stuff. And he said to me, he said he had told Obama that he'd been through it with me where I was hard on him, obviously had to drop out of the race, but that it was better to maintain contact with me than not. But then he didn't follow his own advice. So
do you think Biden should run for
second? He would have ended up not talking to me anyway, because I wrote a column about how we should acknowledge his seventh grandchild.
Right.
So if he hadn't stopped anything having to do with Hunter, he is paralyzed. As you can see, he can't tell Hunter when Hunter is going over the line, and he can't accept anyone who tries to tell him. So because Hunter is at so much at the center of the drama, it would have happened anyway,
Maureen, why do you think Biden shouldn't run for a second term?
I think he's putting the country in a little bit of jeopardy because his ratings are so bad. And I think if he would leave and take the win, he would have a much stronger place in the history books than if he has, if he loses to Trump, that's going to be a disaster. But I also think that, unfortunately, Kamala Harris has turned out not to be a strong presence in politics. And the combination of Biden's age with her, like if his vice president were Gretchen Whitmer, it might be a different story because people would, you know, think, well, what if something happens to him, but it's Gretchen Whitmer. But Kamala, you know, is very unpopular and Biden's very unpopular. So that combination is not a good one.
Yeah. Maureen, you've also interviewed, profiled, and even befriended many people in Hollywood, from Mel Brooks to Greta Gerwig. Who among all of those profiles that you've done did you find the funniest person and the easiest to make funny in your profile writing?
Well, Mel Brooks was amazing, obviously. Mm-hmm. I was worried because he's, you know, he's up there. But he was so sharp and so with it. And I just wish I could have talked to him for another 20 hours. You know, he was amazing. I'm trying to think of...
Well, your profile of Mel Brooks is outstanding. And we'll link to it with the podcast in case people have missed it. It's really one of my favorite profiles you've ever done. It's
fantastic. Anne Roth was fun. She's a famous costume designer who's 91, and she had a cameo in the Barbie movie. And she's just a really, really cool woman. You know, it's just inspiring when you get to meet some of these people, and they are just firing on all cylinders in their 90s.
Yeah, for sure. What did you learn going on late night talk shows about humor?
Oh, well, I was on Jon Stewart's show, and I was terrified because I'm always terrified of public appearances. And, you know, I killed. I couldn't believe it. It was fantastic. And I made a joke about the other columnists and Paul Krugman, and Jon Stewart said, "Do you guys have that hanging cat poster in your hall?" And, you know... And then I went on David Letterman, and I tried to make a joke about Paul Krugman. And during the break, Letterman leaned over to me, and he goes, "Never make a joke about Paul Krugman again. No one has heard of him." And I realized you really have to know your audience. Like, Jon Stewart's audience was very aware and up on the news, and David Letterman's, you know, was broader.
I love that. In today's digital age, Maureen, what are the benefits and the challenges of writing humor pieces at the decidedly unhumorous paper of record compared to, say, a site with a more, I don't know, casual tone?
Well, as you know, Don, you know, everything is more intense at the New York Times. We're just under a microscope, and things that wouldn't be a problem other places are a problem for us. And in fact, you know, A.G. Sulzberger wrote to us a few years ago, and there had been a couple satires by my colleagues that didn't quite hit, and he wrote and he said, "I think we should dispense with satires during the Trump administration because it's too hard to tell what is real and what is false. And Trump is confusing that all the time. And I think we should not confuse the readers any further." And you know, at first I was sort of sniffy, like I wrote to my editor, like, "Is that what Jonathan Swift's editors told him?" But satires are very hard. And when I went and looked at some of mine, you know, before I talked to you, and it's just some people might like them, some people might not, they might not work. You know, I let Aaron Sorkin write one about President Bartlett once. And, you know, it's an acquired taste. They might work, they might not. They're very hard to do. And just to prove AG's point, when I was covering the Clintons, when Hillary, in the brief period where she was going from first lady to senator, she, someone called me one Christmas Eve with a tip about how all of her rich friends in Hollywood were giving $10,000 or $20,000 or something for a sort of a, you know, a shower, you might call it, for her to move into her new home in Embassy Row. So you're not allowed to accept gifts above 100, I think, as first lady and 250 as senator or vice versa. And she, it was kind of a not cool thing to do. But I explained that what happened was there was a registration set up at Warren Buffett's store in Omaha, Borsheim's, and you could buy her $2,000 silver soup tureen where she'd be entertaining donors for her future run, or salad tongs for $750. And it sounds insane, but you know, it was an amazing, I thought it was an amazing scoop, but people didn't pay attention because they thought it was a satire. Nobody thought the Clintons had really, that Hillary Clinton had set up like a bridal registry for rich people to pay for her silverware in her new house. Because Bill Clinton had just gotten $8 million for his memoir and Hillary was going to get some huge amount. So it just seemed crazy. So I got all these letters like, that was a really stupid satire and you should stop writing satire. So I understand what AG is saying. But then later, Bill Clinton told Jonathan Alter for Newsweek, Jonathan asked him about it. And he's like, oh, yeah, we did that. But nobody noticed. But so I understand what he means that. But my favorite form of humor actually is real stuff that's funny in life rather than satires. Like, for instance, I went with W once when he was, he went to Germany and Paris to try and talk European leaders into supporting him in the Iraq War, which was a kind of a fruitless quest. And he gave a speech to the German parliament and he said to them, you know, you guys just don't understand what a bad guy Saddam is. He gassed his own people. And it was like the scene in The Producers. The German parliament just looked back at him like, you don't think we know? You know, and then one time his father and Gorbachev had a summit, a superpower summit in Malta, and 41 really wanted it to be cool, and he went to have it on his yacht and all this stuff. And then there was a hurricane, and Bush couldn't get off the yacht, and all the American officials were throwing up, and Gorbachev and Raisa were on land rolling their eyes, like, what the hell happened to the summit? And, you know, there's a lot of really crazy, funny stuff that happens in life. So I think the funnier thing is like real life in a way.
Yeah, but you're great at both. You're great at capturing both. I want to talk to you a little bit about criticism and you being critical and then people being critical of you. So first, your criticism of people, does it come naturally to you, being critical of public figures?
No.
I mean, I know the answer to the question, but I wanted to ask it anyway. But I want to explore this.
No, I grew up in a very, you know, authoritarian, patriarchal world between the Catholic Church and all girls' schools, and my dad was a police detective. So, you know, to become a kind of a verbal sniper and, a critique for a living is hard. That's why, as I said earlier, I didn't even think I could do it.
Right. And then I'm curious about the way readers...
And I first started the column, and I think you probably remember this. I was so unnerved. I would just come home and roll up in a little ball on the floor, and my skin was breaking out, and my hair was falling out. And one Friday night, I just passed the mirror, and I saw myself, and I had a mask on my hair, and I had Clearasil all over my face, and a chicken leg, Popeye's chicken, in my mouth. I looked in the mirror and I thought, I bet Bill Sapphire is having a more elegant Friday night. So I was basically a bundle of nerves. And it still is very nerve-wracking to, you know, challenge authority at the level that you can at the New York Times.
Yeah, well, you're completely fearless. It's one of the things we all love about you. But then I wanted to ask about readers. Have readers become more sensitive to criticism? I mean, you're coming up on your 30 years of writing your column. Has the audience evolved where they recognized the cuttingness and liked it a lot, let's say 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, and are losing a taste for it now in this more hypersensitive era about everything, particularly about speech?
Well, even my family, you know, my family are Republican, and so when a Democratic president is in and I'm poking them, they love me. And when a Republican president is in, you know, they get mad at me and snipe at me at Thanksgiving dinner, tell me I don't know what I'm talking about. So that's the, you know, microcosm. But Times readers, Times readers are so intelligent. Like, sometimes I read the letters to the editor and they're better than all of our columns, you know? So you don't want to get on the wrong side of Times readers, but I can't think about that. I remember one time I covered an auction of J.D. Yeah. Salinger's letters to Joyce Maynard, who was a Times person for a while, who he had some weird love thing with.
Oh, yeah.
And he wrote to her and he said, you know, don't get swayed by the applause any more than you get swayed by the jeers, because the applause can be just as warping. So I try not to really study, you know, whether I'm getting applause or jeers, and just stick to what I think needs to be said.
And in the jeers category, your columns have been compared to political cartoons.
Oh, yeah. Actually, that was the biggest compliment I ever got. The political cartoonists asked me to speak at their convention because they said my column was the most like political cartoons. And I love that. I mean, because what you want as a writer is to be painting pictures and be very visual and, you know, make people think and be a provocateur. And, you know, I just love that. That was, that's great for me. I think that's great.
Maureen, you've turned your column over to various people over the years, sort of guest columnists, underneath your byline. I'm not going to ask you who did it best. I want to know who did the worst job ever.
My brother. No, I'm kidding.
I figured you might say him.
No. He, we had to go. My brother got kidney cancer a few years ago, and his wife has MS, so I went to New York with him to Sloan Kettering for the consultations. And we get into these doctors, and they go, "Are you Kevin Dowd, the New York Times writer?" He would go, "Yes, that's me." And it just made his life, because no one in Washington would say that. So he got to New York, and people had heard his name. And he loves it. And I think it's really important for Times readers to see what Republicans are thinking. And, you know, I love humor. So I've let, like, Seth Meyers and Stephen Colbert and trying to think who else. Like, and I wrote about Letterman. I want to get as much humor in the paper as I can. I would do that full time if I could, but I keep getting interrupted by indictments and impeachments and second and third impeachments. There was an indictment and impeachment this week, I think. You know, I mean, and the Iraq War. You know, for 7 years, I wrote about that crazy, misbegotten war that we never should have gotten into. So you're not going to write humor about that. So I keep, you know, getting distracted by the crazy, stupid things that people here in Washington do.
Yeah, your Stephen Colbert, when you turned over the column of Stephen Colbert, that was back in 2007, and you wrote at the time that you heard him sneering that Times columns make good kindling.
Oh, yeah.
and for that reason, you dared him to write a column, and you said it was in a moment of weakness what you could describe as a coup de moi, which I love that line.
No, so yeah, I interviewed Sarah Silverman, John Leguizamo. I think comedians, you know, they're having the same trouble we're having because of trigger warnings and sensitivities. And Amy Schumer got in trouble this week at the U.S. Open because she made some crack about Nicole Kidman, you know, and everyone's like, you're mean, but, you know, it's Amy Schumer. But they, a lot of them, like Bill Maher and Jerry Seinfeld, are refusing to go to college campuses anymore because they're trying to make jokes and then the students think they're rude. And, you know, it's just a very tough time for all humorists, I think. But we've got to, you know, I was looking over, I did a piece about Jimmy Buffett when he died, and I was looking over his emails and he said, you know, the absence of humor is terror. And, you know, he was angry at Trump because Trump had taken away some of our fun and our laughter because of his evil shenanigans. And, you know, I think that's right. I think we've got to, we just haven't had much laughter in this country, in the public arena, in quite a while now. And I think it's unhealthy.
Maureen, thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks,
you're the best.
Don. Well, you know, you're my favorite.
Next week, we'll talk to a former investigative journalist who left the business and became an Emmy-nominated late-night show writer. Take a Joke is sponsored by Funny Girls, a program from the Harnish Foundation that uses improv education to strengthen girls' leadership skills. This is a series from the Sunday Long Read podcast, an audio extension of the Sunday Long Read newsletter. Since 2014, the SLR has curated the very best journalism every week and drops in your inbox every Sunday morning. For more information, www.sundaylongread.com. You can subscribe to the Sunday Long Read podcast on Spotify or Apple to make sure you don't miss a single episode. My thanks goes to the producers of this episode, Jacob Feldman and Alex Fuse. The executive producer of the podcast is Etienne Lajoie, and the founders of the SLR are Jacob Feldman and me, Don Van Natta. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us next week.